From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the show, reporter Rachel Morello answers a listener question about education in her newest Beats Me segment.
Then, in an era of fad diets and pseudoscience, the founder of a new startup wants to put your genome to work to help you decide what to eat.
It's almost killing me to think, as a professional in genomics and, you know, with knowledge of how different we are, but yet we're facing this one-size-fits-all solutions.
Tony McCauley explains his work to stop the sectarian violence in his home city of Belfast in the 1980s.
And how a tiger moth has evolved to defend itself against its greatest predator.
Can you live through a bat attack or not? That's where these anti-bat defenses really come into play. They help the moths survive that intense predatory selective pressure from the bats.
Lake Effect is next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Wisconsin is home to arguably the largest school choice scene in the country, and many local parents are aware of the public and private school options available to them. But there's one lesser-known alternative, homeschooling. It can take many different forms, and a number of WUWM listeners asked our education reporter Rachel Morello to examine what homeschooling looks like in southeastern Wisconsin. She joins us now. Good morning, Rachel.
Good morning.
So let's talk about what we mean by homeschooling. Can you give us a definition?
Sure. The state defines homeschooling as a home-based private educational program. Basically, it's a parent or guardian providing instruction to their child. There are no rules about curriculum, so parents have a lot of latitude in choosing what their children learn. That's part of the appeal for some families. I spoke with Tim Cushman of Mequon. He's a father of two boys, and he and his wife are considering homeschooling for their young kids.
We can see the possible upsides and benefits of leading their education. Just starting to have kids who are entering school age and just thinking about what are the possibilities, what are our options and opportunities for education. And the more we think about it, the more it seems like an attractive alternative.
Rachel, you mentioned that the state doesn't have requirements regarding curriculum, but what rules are in place for families who choose homeschooling?
It's pretty simple. There are three basic requirements. Parents have to file a homeschool enrollment form with the state. They must provide at least 875 hours of instruction each school year, and the state recommends documenting those hours. And parents have to provide their kids with instruction in reading, language arts, math, social studies, science, and health. And folks can find teaching resources online, as well as from several companies that sell their own curriculum.
This sounds like a significant undertaking for parents. So why is the option so attractive to some families?
Well, I talked to Jake Curtis from Grafton. He and his wife homeschool two of their three children, who are 6 and 8 years old. And he says the flexibility afforded to the family is a primary reason why they homeschool.
Obviously, if you're in a traditional school setting, and for the most part, if your kid doesn't like a class, you know, they kind of have to stay in that class. Here, we initially tried a few things that we didn't think was a good fit for us, and then you just move on to something else. The flexibility is something, you know, that you have in homeschooling that you really don't have in that traditional school setting.
So what concerns, if any, do parents have when they consider homeschooling as an option for them?
Well, some worry about their kids losing out on school activities and socializing. But Jake Curtis says there are resources for families, things like special programming at the YMCA, for example, or the library and nature centers. And parents also may worry about the stigma surrounding homeschooling. But Curtis says that hasn't been much of an issue for his family.
We have not seen much of a stigma. In fact, a lot of people think it's great that parents have the ability to do that and the flexibility and the freedom to do that.
Just how many families participate in homeschooling in Wisconsin?
Well, according to the Department of Public Instruction, approximately 20,000 kids were homeschooled during the 2016-17 school year, and that's a little more than 2% of the school-age population. The majority of homeschool students are in grades 1 through 8, and the biggest homeschool populations can be found in and around southeastern Wisconsin, and Milwaukee has the largest.
Well, thanks so much for the primer, Rachel.
You're welcome.
You can submit your questions for education reporter Rachel Morello at WUWM.com/education. We'll take another break now and then meet two of the people behind a Milwaukee startup that takes a genetic approach to nutrition. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues now on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. There is a lot we can learn from our DNA. Some of it is information that's important, like whether we're predisposed to develop a disease. But there's not always an actionable step to be taken. But there is a lot of information that you can use, like how your body responds to different kinds of foods.
The founder of a Milwaukee-based startup believes that information could fundamentally change how we approach eating and understanding what's good for us. Geno Pallett analyzes a client's genome and offers personalized recommendations about what a person should eat or drink and what they should stay away from.
Sherry Zhang is a researcher in genetics and obesity at the Medical College of Wisconsin and the founder and CEO of Geno Pallett. Laura Danner is a nutritional sciences student at UW-Milwaukee and a nutritional data analyst for Geno Pallett. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
What was the light bulb moment for you? Talk a little bit about your background and how it led to the creation of Geno Pallett.
Sure. I studied obesity genetics research for 10 years, as you know, and I published extensively on the topic. But while I was doing that, obesity went up, didn't come down. And, 2/3 of our American population are obese, overweight, and it's affecting our children and adolescents as well. 17% of them are obese, and 1/3 is overweight. So as I was observing this and knowing that I have a technology which can actually help resolve this problem from the molecular level and by reading your DNA, I thought I need to do something. That's why I founded Geno Pallett last year.
Are all the answers to obesity encoded in the human genome?
It's a mixture of the interaction between our genome or the genes and the environment. Evolutionarily, our human nutrition has profoundly shaped our genome and so made a lot of mutations naturally happen during your ancestry and versus mine. And, that caused the differences in your genome if we compare to my sequences. And we call those single nucleotide polymorphism or SNPs. So between you and I, for example, we differ in about 3 to 4 million of SNPs. Lots of this shaping actually are, inducing the genetic variation into the nutritional aspects, right? So that increase our survival rate in our ancestors, For example, your ancestors may come from a tribe who can digest a lot of fats. If they are cattle farming for many years, and they probably develop that mutation, which make them be able to digest the lactose, which put them at a high advantage over people like my ancestors, who have been living on rice for thousands of years. And sure enough, when I took my Geno Pallett test, and I'm lactose intolerant. So give you an example of how different the environmental cues can shape our genomes and affecting how we digest our food today.
Okay, so how did this light bulb moment end up sparking a company?
As we know, everybody is unique. Even identical twins, they will have difference in the SNPs that we just talked about. So because of that, it's almost killing me to think as a professional in genomics and with knowledge of how different we are, but yet we're facing this one-size-fits-all solutions that are bombarding us on a daily basis. We'll see so many choices when we go out to grocery shopping. We'll hear so many different fat diets every other month. Which one is really good for you and me? And I don't think they have the answer, but the answer is right in our genes. Personalization is really what Geno Pallett is trying to deliver. So it starts with reading your DNA, and I know you have done your 23andMe DNA.
Right, I had my genome sequenced.
Yeah, and DNA testing. So you went through the drill. We have a way that people can sign up for genome palette analysis and online. And then once we got that order, we send a home saliva collection kit to your home or to your any address that you pointed to.
And everything you need to know about someone is contained in their saliva.
Yes, pretty much.
It's amazing to think about.
Yes, yes. More than you can imagine or you want to know sometimes, right? We read your evolutionary past and we also ask you a bunch of questions. So we need to know their state of health and lifestyle and demographic and age and gender. All this information are asked through a personal form, through a questionnaire that we send it out to them, as you already did.
Right, exactly.
So back to the saliva collection. So it's a very easy-peasy, non-invasive collection kit sent to your home. You spit into your tube and then send that tube drop in the mail, and that will be sent to our lab. At the lab, we actually interrogated all your genomic differences, the SNPs we just talked about. But we focused on 38 biomarkers particularly because these are the 38 markers that each of them have evidence and shown in hundreds to thousands of people in clinical trials or studies that will indicate certain digestion in metabolic differences in you in terms of certain food.
These are the biomarkers that you can interpret with the most reliability at this point.
Correct.
And Laura Danner, I gather this is where you come in.
Right. So I've been working very closely under the registered dietitian on the team. And with his guidance, I've been able to take a look at these specific biomarkers that, you know, we're investigating, and to take that comprehensively with the data that we gather from our health questionnaire and really integrate that information into specific nutritional recommendations. So we're able to look at, you know, their genotypes and their specific needs that their DNA is telling them that they need to, you know, eat perhaps more of a certain nutrient or consume less of a certain substance, and then to combine that with the demographic data and using guidelines from the FDA and the USDA to really put that together into the specific recommendations for vitamin and mineral needs for a day and, you know, people's specific calorie needs, and then really breaking it down specifically with the information in our biomarker panel to specific ratios of the different macronutrients like carbohydrates, fats, and proteins, and then breaking it down even further into specific requirements for the different types of fats and the different types of carbohydrates. So it really is a very complex process, and you know, it's personalized at every level, which is, I think, the real value for the customer, is that, you know, we're able to take a look at their whole
holistic.
Yeah, we're able to take a holistic view of their health and really kind of take a snapshot of where they are right now in their lives, and then also, you know, integrate that with the information in their genetic history, and give them that clear path forward.
Sherry, you had studied for years the genetics of obesity, but this isn't entirely about obesity, mm-hmm. right? I mean, yeah. I would imagine that your clients, your customers, the people that come to you are looking for a variety of answers.
Yeah. People have a struggle with certain specific issues in their wellness, but not necessarily sick, need to go to the hospital for that. But I believe a better nutrition can be applied as a medicine for a lot of things and prevent the illness from happening. So this is really a fall into the preventive care that the whole health system is trying to going towards.
So as we'd mentioned, I'd had my genome sequenced independently, and you ran the computer analysis on my genome as an example. But when somebody supplies you with a saliva sample and you do the genome sequencing and then you run the computer analysis, what comes back to them?
Yeah. So as you see, you will get a comprehensive report, but also tailored very friendly to each user with any kind of background in science that will explain, okay, what are the 38 markers we read for you and what does it mean in terms of the relevance to your health and the food choices. And then we integrate all this information thanks to analysts like Laura here, and we explain what kind of dietary framework you need to comply with that gives you the best possible low-risk health outcomes. And also, we don't want you to sacrifice the flavor and enjoyment in eating. So we want to change this, you know, clinical setting, you know, take a few pounds off. We're watching program into something daily usable nutritional solutions. And towards the end, we also generate your own personal nutrition label. That in terms of when you go to the shop, you see a lot of labels on other food items that has nothing to do with Mitch or Sherry.
Right.
And this is ours. So I can use it. I use it a lot. Also, our users really like that piece where they use it as a reference card when you go shopping or care about your health. Another piece we have is similar to that is a personal supplement table. That based on FDA and all those authorities' guidelines, and we also take into account your genotype that we have biomarkers for certain vitamins and so on. So all these are presented in a friendly way. A new piece we generated is a grocery list, right? At the end of the day, I want to know, okay, all this information, how do I use it when I go shopping? We're busy professional people, and you know, people are busier with their life now, and they want to be able to use it for their benefit, and we want to make it easier for them.
Well, and so let's talk about some of the information that comes out of this. And we can talk, you know, specifically about maybe one issue within the analysis you did on my genome. We're not going to give everything away here, of course. You know, there's one biomarker that shows I would benefit from limiting the intake of chicken and other lean meat, and another biomarker that shows it would be beneficial. So how do you address, you know, these kind of inherent inconsistencies that might come across as you analyze a genome?
So let me explain in your case, if you might may.
Absolutely.
Thank you for sharing this private information on the radio. That turkey and chicken, this is a great example where people, you know, canonically think, oh, this is the white meat and very healthy, so lean and nothing wrong with it. But what turned out when we really looking at their nutritional facts and carefully, we found that actually our poultry is with a higher content of something, a fatty acid, it's omega-6 called arachidonic acid, which in nutritional studies and previously done, showing that people have a genotype for this particular omega-6 metabolism may be on at higher risk for developing higher BMI, so obesity, as compared to other genotypic background people. So because that insights and to the molecular level, we actually recommend in your case, where eat this food in a moderation. So I think that's a good example of showing personalized nutritional insights are important.
Laura, there's another biomarker in this analysis that might have particular interest in a place like Wisconsin, and it is linked to alcohol consumption. Can you talk about what that biomarker shows?
Absolutely. So that biomarker specifically deals with a gene that's been kind of a hot topic recently that deals with folate and homocysteine metabolism. So that's the MTHFR gene, and that's one that we do test for. So in this case specifically, people who have a mutation in their MTHFR gene, if they consume alcohol, then that can lead to a buildup of homocysteine in their circulating levels of homocysteine, which has been linked to an increase in cardiovascular disease. And that's due to the body's inability to process folate, which is a necessary metabolite for converting homocysteine back into its more neutral form, methionine. So it's, you know, that's one of the things that it's very important for people to know, that I think most people without having this genetic information may not know that they're at an increased risk for developing cardiovascular disease based on their alcohol consumption.
Where would you hope this goes from here? Are there dreams you have of the things that you could do as Genopallet grows?
Yeah, there are so many. First of all, we want to be able to serve as many people as we can. And the more people join us, and will also empower us in terms of the analytical modeling and make it more precise over time. Just like when the more you shop on Amazon, the more precise and the recommendations are from them to you, right? They know exactly how you like and what kind of brands and all that is your preferences. Exactly what happened with your profiling for your nutrition and healthy living. Over time, I want to build this long-term relationship with each individual so we can learn and work on the nutritional life together and go on this journey for a lifetime.
Well, Sherry Zhang and Laura Danner, thanks to both of you so much, and best of luck with your work.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. It's always a pleasure to be here.
Sherry Zhang is founder and CEO of a Milwaukee-based startup called Genopallet. Laura Danner is a nutritional sciences student at UW-Milwaukee and is a nutritional data analyst for the company. You can find a link to more and see a sample genome report at WUWM.com. Our interview with the two of them first aired last month.
Another quick break, and then we meet writer and peace activist Tony McCauley, who explains his work to stop the sectarian violence in his home city of Belfast in the 1980s. More of Lake Effect comes your way in a moment on WUWM.
This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie Miller.
And I'm Mitch Tyler. There's a lot of talk about the violence that affects urban America, and it is a serious situation. Drive-by shootings, carjackings, and other crime affects the fabric of this country. But very little of that violence has the sectarian underpinnings of the time known as the Troubles, which plagued the Northern Ireland city of Belfast for three decades, starting in 1969.
Writer Tony McCauley was born Protestant in West Belfast in 1963, and the Troubles began when he was a small child. His previous book, Bread Boy, looks back on his childhood there, but his latest book jumps forward in time to when the 23-year-old McCauley set out to stop the violence between Catholics and Protestants in Belfast. The book is called Little House on the Peace Line, and McCauley joined us via Skype from his home in Belfast back in August to explain what his plan was back then.
It's the period of 1985 to 1988, and I was 22, 23 years old, and I just graduated from university, and I was just about to get married, and I got my first job, and my first job was as a youth worker in North Belfast at the height of the Troubles, the civil conflict in Northern Ireland. As you may know, in Northern Ireland, we have a very divided city of Belfast between Catholic neighbourhoods and Protestant neighbourhoods. And those neighbourhoods are separated by large fences and walls, euphemistically called peace walls. But in those days, there were many, many peace lines separating the two communities at a time of, you know, great tension and violence. And I was a young, idealistic young man with a real commitment to building peace and trying to make a difference, to stop the violence, to try to find a way of bringing people together. And so I went to live right on the peace line, right beside one of the peace walls. My wife and I got married, and we bought our first little house right there. We're both Protestants, and we bought a house on the Catholic side of the peace line. So we went to live on the peace line. We went to live on the opposite side of the peace line from the community in which we had grown up. And I started to work with Catholic young people, and my wife was working with Protestant young people. And we brought them together to meet each other and make friends in our little house. And we called it The Little House on the Peace Line. So that's the name of the new book.
A lot of people hearing this might think, oh my gosh, you're mad. Why would you think to do that in the middle of the violence? And you describe a lot of it in the book. I mean, this is the era of drive-by shootings and people throwing petrol bombs. And it could have been for anything. And there's such a devastating loss of life. For no particular reason other than sectarianism. And it must have been difficult.
It was a very dark time. It really was. It was a period of time where it felt like, you know, this conflict was going to go on forever. By 1985, the conflict broke out in 1969. You know, we'd been through a lot of trauma as a community in the preceding decades. And it just seemed to be getting worse and not getting any better. It seemed like we were going to be stuck in this conflict forever. So it was a dark time. In the area that I worked, it was known as Murder Mile. And it was called Murder Mile because it was a mile from the city centre out of Belfast, which had the highest intensity of sectarian killings in the whole of Northern Ireland. And it also was the area that I worked in. It had 90% youth unemployment at that time, partly because of the economy at that time, but partly because of the conflict. Unemployment was a huge problem in Belfast in that era, and particularly unemployment for young people. So people said to me at the time it was a crazy thing to do. When I look back now, I think it was a risky thing to do. It was an idealistic thing to do, and maybe a little bit naive in some ways, to be honest with you, Bonnie. But it's something that I don't regret doing, because very few people in Northern Ireland have had the experience of, you know, walking in the other person's moccasins. It's not an experience that very many people here have had.
And, you know, you would say that that's part of the problem is that, and you make the point in the book over and over in lots of different ways, that you grew up in just as much of a blinded worldview as the people on the Catholic side of things. And if you don't make the effort to learn about the other people and find out that they are just people just like you, you're never going to change.
Yes. So, you know, everyone in my street was a Protestant when I was growing up. I went to the school, my primary school. Everyone at school was a Protestant. I obviously went to a Protestant church. We played Protestant sports, socialized with Protestants. And, you know, 1 mile away on the other side of a wall, Catholics were going to a Catholic school. They were living in a Catholic street. They were going to a Catholic church playing Irish sports. Although we lived so close together, it was like living in two parallel universes. And the interesting thing that I discovered when I crossed that divide and went to experience what it was like living on the other side, I noticed that both sides had myths about each other. And we learnt all the prejudices about the other side from our own side. And it was being passed down the generations. And it was really only when I took the step to cross over to the other side that I started to hear things from a different perspective. I got to hear, for me as a Protestant, I got to hear a different experience, for example, of the British Army and the police, who, and many people in the Protestant community would have seen those as protecting us from the IRA. Whereas when I was living in the Catholic community, what I experienced there was many people saw the British Army as an oppressive force to continue the historic oppression of Irish people. So it was I got to experience all of that firsthand.
I have to say, it's a very funny book, too, because you are a funny writer. All of your books have this humor, even though you're dealing with such very serious and very dark things. The humor comes out both in the characters that we meet through your work on the peace line. I'm thinking of the boys in the youth club. I felt like I got to know them so well, and I wanted to meet them.
Great. Oh, that's good. That's lovely to hear. Because it was important to me that I brought to life their experience and their attitude. And on the one hand, in many ways, they were simply by being born and growing up at this time, they were victims of this whole situation that they were living through. And, you know, so they hadn't got jobs. They often had very, you know, prejudiced views about people who were different, but they'd never had an opportunity to meet someone who was different. In some ways, they'd been brutalized by growing up in a violent society for so many years. Many had lost loved ones. And some of them also were attacked as well in some of these drive-by shootings that you mentioned. So, but at the same time, we do have quite a dark sense of humour in Belfast. And I suppose in a way it helped us to get through the darkest of times. You know, having that sense of humour, that ability not to take ourselves too seriously and to be able to see some humour to get us through the difficult times. It's a very Belfast characteristic.
At the end of the book, you talk about 30 years later going back and seeing the changes that have happened. I know the book is just coming out, but have you been in touch with any of those kids that you worked with 30 years ago? And have any of them read any of this?
Well, some of them came to the Belfast book launch, which was wonderful. I was delighted to see them. And I met up with one of the guys recently who asked me for a signed copy, and I met up with him to give him a copy. And I actually sent a copy to one of the guys who actually is currently in prison in Germany on charges related to the Troubles. So now I haven't had feedback directly so far from them, but I hope they think that I've represented them fairly and with dignity. I mean, one of the young people in the youth club sadly was murdered during the course of the time I was there, and I invited his mother to the book launch because I dedicated the book to him, and his mother and his sisters came along to the launch, and I thought that was really very special. She was delighted that someone was remembering her son, because, you know, there were so many teenagers like him who lost their lives. There's a book here in Northern Ireland called Lost Lives, and it lists everyone who died, and you turn the pages, Bonnie, and there's just scores and scores of young men like him who are in many ways forgotten. It's desperately sad to read that. So I was delighted when I asked his mother permission to dedicate the book to him, that she agreed and she came along to the launch, and in some way it let her know that he was being remembered, and he was being remembered with respect, you know, in spite of the horrific events that ended his life.
Well, respect and love, I would say, too.
Oh, good. Well, I hope that comes across. This was a kid who his father had been murdered when he was only 2 years old. His father was killed in a horrific pub bombing, and he grew up with that awareness. And of course, that, you know, there was an element of hatred in his heart as a result of that. Because of what had been done to his father, and it tortured him. It made him very sad. As a result, you know, he drank too much, and even though he was really a teenager, he was drinking too much, and that part of that was just the trauma of what had happened to his father. And then, you know, he was abused and harassed by others, you know, and they used the death of his father to harass him, which I thought was a terribly cruel thing to do. And then ultimately he himself had his life taken away from him. You know, if he'd been born anywhere else at another period of time, he would have grown up. He'd have met a lovely girl. He'd have got married. He'd have kids now. And he, you know, like some of those other young people who did survive, he could have had a happy life. So it is desperately sad.
What do you think the long-term legacy of all of that is for those boys that you were working with now 30 years on? What are their children absorbing from that time?
Well, I suppose the really positive thing is that we've had a few reunions of the old youth club, and most of those guys have done really well. You know, at the time they were wild. That's the only word I can describe.
Pretty wild, yes.
they were wild, and they were involved in all sorts of things. But most of them have got themselves decent jobs. They have families. Their kids are doing, you know, they were talking to me about their kids doing well at school, And, you know, in spite of the really difficult start that they had in life, many of them have done really well for themselves. And I think that's wonderful. And it's nice when they mention perhaps that you contributed in some way to that by, you know, the in a small way by having some influence on them all those years ago.
And there was one young man at towards the end of the book when you, it's time for you and Leslie to move on and do other things with your lives. It's Dan, and he basically says, everyone leaves us.
Yeah.
And that broke my heart.
Yeah. And it's, yeah, that and you know, that's a very vivid memory, him saying that to me, because I was so passionate and so dedicated to what I was doing. But ultimately, he was right. I was choosing to leave. I would have burnt out if I'd stayed there any longer doing what I was doing, and in some ways I had to leave, but it was true. And he said, it's interesting, I met one of the other youth workers who has read the book recently, and he said, you know what, he said that to me a few years later when I left as well.
Yeah.
So, you know, and but he's an interesting person, that particular boy. He's done really well. He's now a governor in an integrated school in North Belfast.
Good for
that's
him.
What he's doing.
That's great.
That's fantastic. That was really good.
I was going to say, that should make you feel pretty proud.
I'm very proud of him that he's done that, and he believes in that, and he's contributing to the peace by build, you know, being part of that sort of integrated education movement.
Are you hopeful that things in the future will continue on the good path, whatever form that takes, whether it's reunification or not?
Yeah, I'm still optimistic and hopeful. Things have changed dramatically since my childhood. I mean, my children have never experienced violence or the things that I grew up living with. My children are children of the peace, whereas I was a child of the Troubles. My children were educated in an integrated school right throughout their whole childhood. And that's a huge difference from when I was growing up. So I'm still very hopeful. We've come an awful long way. I suppose I'm still quite idealistic. I would love Northern Ireland to be a really integrated society. We're now a very peaceful society. You know, Belfast is buzzing. Our tourism industry is you know, really thriving. The film industry that's going on in Northern Ireland, you know, with Game of Thrones and everything, is just really exciting. I mean, it's just amazing the difference. But we're still more divided than I'm comfortable with. I would love us to have, you know, I'd love most of our kids to be at integrated schools. I would love Catholics and Protestants to be living in the same streets again. I would love all of those peace walls to be torn down forever. It feels at the minute like we're living alongside each other peacefully rather than really living together happily.
So a little bit of work to do.
Yeah, more work to do. But I suppose one of the things that I've learned over the years, and probably as a result of my experience in the peace line in the 1980s, was that it does take time. Some of these changes are generational. Back in 1995, I could not have imagined the level of peace that we have today. I really couldn't have imagined it. And it's so precious. And I do, as I said, I think it's irreversible. But at the same time, because of my experience of, you know, living on both sides, I just think, you know, I think we're really good people. We just need to respect and understand and value each other more. You know, we still don't fully trust our neighbors in the way that I think it would be great if we could.
Well, Tony McCauley, we are so looking forward to having you visit us again. It's been a couple of years since you were at Irish Fest last. I want to thank you so much for taking time to talk with me today.
My pleasure, Bonnie. It's lovely to talk to you again.
Tony McCauley is a best-selling author, leadership consultant, peace builder, broadcaster, and suicide prevention advocate from Northern Ireland. His newest book is Little House on the Peace Line, Living and Working as a Pacifist on Belfast's Murder Mile. We first spoke with him in August.
We'll take one last break and then hear a story about the surprising rivalry between moths and bats. Lake Effect returns with that in just a moment on WUWM.
Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tite.
And I'm Bonnie North. If you walk near the lake at night, there is a good chance you'll see bats swooping through the air to feast on insects. What you might not see or hear is the aerial warfare at play, dividing the weak and the strong in a battle for survival that has spanned millions of years.
Back in early October, Dr. Nicholas Dowdy gave a lecture on the evolutionary arms race between bats and tiger moths at the Milwaukee Public Museum. Before that, he joined Lake Effect's Joy Powers in the studio to explain more about this rivalry.
Tiger moths are an extremely diverse subfamily of moths. There are 11,000 species worldwide, and they're medium-sized to large moths, although some of them actually are very small, too, so they kind of span the moth size range, I guess. And visually, most of them are actually very colorful, so you might think of them more as, like, you know, quote-unquote butterflies. But, you know, butterflies and moths are actually both in the same group. They're both Lepidoptera. They're just separated mainly by whether they're active during the day or night in their evolutionary history. The other key thing about tiger moths is that they actually have the ability to produce sound in response to bat echolocation and sometimes also in courtship. And that is pretty unique among moths.
So moths don't normally make sound.
So we're sort of still learning a lot about that. We do know that tiger moths do that, but we're sort of finding out more and more that other moths are doing that too. But the majority of moths out there, no, they're not producing sound that we know of right now. But the majority of moths actually do hear sound, which is really interesting.
So for tens of millions of years, tiger moths have been in competition in some ways with bats. You call it, in fact, intense selective pressure from bats. What do you mean by that?
Well, bats are very hungry, and they're very good at hunting insects. In my talk, I'm going to give some figures, but, I mean, basically, they eat a tremendous amount of insects. Some people have estimated that they provide the United States alone about maybe $30 billion in biocontrol of pest insects, which is huge. And their ability to eat so many insects per night, I mean, that is the driver of evolution and natural selection. It's differential survivability. Do you survive or do you not survive? Can you live through a bat attack or not? And it's where that's where these anti-bat defenses really come into play. They help the moths survive that intense predatory selective pressure from the bats.
Are bats in particular attracted to tiger moths? Is there anything unique about them that would make them particularly delicious?
No, actually, there's a lot of things that make tiger moths particularly not delicious. I didn't mention this before, but another unique thing about tiger moths is that many of them, what we call sequester, or they basically take chemicals from plants to use in their own defense against bats. So as caterpillars, or sometimes even as adults, they will go to toxic plants and they will feed on them. And normally, toxic plants, they have these compounds to stop insects from feeding on them because they are very harmful to most insects. But tiger moths have special biochemical adaptations which allow them to not only overcome those plant defenses but also take those defenses for themselves and use them against their bat predators or even their invertebrate predators or bird predators too.
So this is one of the defenses they've built up over millions of years.
About 50 million years, yeah.
About 50 million years. And really what your lecture is about is all the different kinds of defenses they've developed. What are some of the other things they use to fend off bats?
So the key one is hearing. You've got to be able to hear the predator coming in order to do something about it. The second one is sound production. So once you know that the predator is coming, what are you going to do about it? In addition to sound production, what most other moths do is actually evasion. So this was something first studied in about the early 1960s by a neuroethologist, which is basically just somebody who studies the neuronal basis of behavior. And they found that moths have two major evasive maneuvers. One is he called a turn-away behavior, which is sort of like if the bat is far away, you turn around and you fly in the opposite direction. Very straightforward, easy to understand. The other one is much more interesting and fun to study, and it's called evasive dives. So these are like when the bat is very close to the moth about to make a capture, the moth will do these crazy spiraling dives, and this allows the moth to make sort of a quick escape at the last second to get away from the bat. So there's been a lot of studies recently taking some new technologies like 3D videography and stuff and measuring flight performance of insects doing these dives and how effective the dives are versus when the insects are not doing dives, when they basically you take away their ability to hear the predator coming, and you can compare their performance with hearing and dives and without hearing and without dives. So that's really, really neat. Other sort of non-acoustic defenses exist as well, and I will talk about some of those. So recent studies have shown that Luna moths may be able to use those long tails that they have coming off of their hind wings as a diversion against bat attacks. So as the bat is coming in to attack the moth, instead of attacking the body of the moth, they may attack the tail instead. And I believe they found that with tails intact in their experiments, the moth survived about 60% of the time, which is great. Without their tails, they were captured like 80% of the time. So huge effect, it seems. Some other non-acoustic defenses. This one I'm really interested in, and that is like acoustic stealth sort of technology, which is really pretty crazy. So some researchers studied – this is actually another tiger moth. But instead of their sound production, they actually looked at the body covering of the moth. So moths are – pretty much all moths are covered in what we call scales. And they're sort of like little tiny pieces of exoskeleton shingled, kind of like on the roof of your house, maybe the shingles on your house. But in those shingles, they looked at the microstructure of those, and they found that they had this – really interesting sort of lattice structure. And they did some experiments and found that relative to a butterfly, which shouldn't be under any selective pressure from bats really, those particular types of scales absorbed bat ultrasound by 5 to 6%. So that decreased sort of the distance by which the bats could detect them by about 5 or 6%. So it's sort of like a like a B-2 stealth bomber, trying to hide from radar. It's the same idea, but it's in moth scales.
I'm talking to Dr. Nick Dowdy. He is currently working at the Milwaukee Public Museum, and he's about to give a lecture on moths, specifically tiger moths, and how they defend against bats. And so we have mostly insectivore bats around here. Do we have different types of tiger moths?
Oh, yeah. In Wisconsin, I don't know the exact number of species here. I mean, it's certainly not the most diverse place in terms of tiger moth diversity. You really have to go south to get that. But even in Wisconsin, I would say we have at least probably 10 to 12 species, which is pretty good. And a lot of those are producing sound in response to bat echolocation. There's actually also a surprising number of bat species in Wisconsin. I believe there's about like 11 or 12 of those too. So it's actually a really great place to be to study bat-moth interactions.
Is this something that people could see if they walked out to, say, the lake in a bat box, per se?
Yes, you could. You would need some special equipment, nothing too crazy. So you'd need like a flashlight or a headlamp to be able to see what was going on. It would be a lot easier to see the bats flying around and doing their thing. The moths are kind of small, and you need a trained eye to sort of see like, oh, yeah, that's this moth. It's hard to do at night when they're flying around. You can get there. I'm there, but it takes years to get there. Now, if you want to hear what's going on, so most of this is in ultrasound. So ultrasound means sound that is not audible to humans, which is above 20,000 hertz. That's the pitch is above there. There are things that you can by to help you hear those things. We call those bat detectors. It's basically like a small box with a microphone and a speaker on it. And that microphone picks up the ultrasound and sort of slows it down and converts it to things humans can hear. And you'll hear little chirps and buzzes and things that the bats are making. So that's a lot of fun to check out.
All right. Well, Nick Dowdy, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect. And we look forward to the lecture.
Thank you very much. I'm looking forward to seeing you there.
Dr. Nick Dowdy is a postdoctoral research fellow working at the Milwaukee Public Museum. There is more information about bats versus moths at WUWM.com. And that wraps up today's edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for joining us.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Great to have you listening today. And I sure hope you'll be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, your NPR station in Milwaukee.
Fresh air comes your way next, so stay tuned. It's 11 o'clock.